This episode is brought to you by Say. Say's V2 upgrade introduces the first high-performance parallelized EVM already live on public DevNet. Mainnet comes later in Q2. You can follow along with the Say journey on X at Say Network. Say is spelled S-E-I. Go follow Say on X, Say Network. This episode is brought to you by Monad, which has not only the highest performance EVM L1 architecture ever built, but also the wildest and craziest community in crypto. Monad's internal DevNet is live and public testnet comes out soon. So make sure you join the Monad community today at discord.gg/Monad. M-O-N-A-D, Monad. Hey everyone, Santi and I have been talking about Solana a lot recently, and we're excited to have a Solana sponsor of Empire, Marinade. Marinade is a staking protocol on Solana and the only stake pool that delivers auto rebalancing, MEV rewards, and automatic downside protection with their new protected staking rewards. Optimize your SOL stake with Marinade by hitting the link in the show notes. Big thanks to Marinade. We'll talk more about them later in the show. This episode is brought to you by Mantle. Mantle is an L2 backed by over a $4 billion treasury, obviously one of the largest in the industry. They recently launched their airdrop program called the Reward Station to distribute both pre-sale token allocations or listed tokens to MNT holders who stake their MNT. Mantle has nailed their rewards program recently. Would highly encourage folks to check out the Mantle Rewards program at mantle.xyz/rewards-station. Although our guest this week is a managing partner of a registered investment advisor, nothing in this podcast should be considered an offer of Multicoin's investment advisory services or should otherwise be confused for investment, tax, legal, or other financial advice. All right, everyone. Welcome back. We got the roundup. We got special guest Kyle Samani from Multicoin. Kyle, welcome to the show, man.
Jason Santi, good to be back. Good to see y'all, boys.
Yeah.
Repeat. I mean, you guys have been 4 or 5 times now on Empire?
Yeah. Something like that. We're regular in the block.
Kyle, you're looking very tan. Is it all the biking or?
a little bit of cycling. I was in Hawaii for my birthday a couple weeks ago. Nice. I was just in Portugal with my mom walking. So just been outside a lot.
Nice.
Touching grass, as they say.
Yeah.
Touching grass.
I'm looking very pale. I got to get outside.
I was about to say something and I was like, that's not appropriate. He's hosting the podcast.
I'm looking at myself next to you. It's honestly
First of all, I don't think you've ever held back on the appropriateness of like that. Let's make you podcast. But like, come on.
Well, Santi's got a face for radio over here. So, you know. all right, guys. Well, the reason we wanted to do this is I made this comment on the roundup like a week or two ago where I said, we were talking about how, Santi and I were talking about how to value these crypto assets. And I said, look, maybe for these L1s and L2s, you should really just value them like a commodity. Like everyone's talking about revenues and expenses for L1s. And I think that might be the wrong way to look at it. I think you should probably just value these things like they're commodities. And if you look at how commodities trade, so whether it's wheat or gold or whatever it is, it's just a supply and demand game. So like the price of wheat will really move when there's like a drought in a place where that produces wheat and there's like a supply shock in the quote L1 asset, basically in the commodity. And I said, maybe these things should just trade like that. And Kyle, you DM me and said, hey, look, I think you're thinking about it in kind of the right way, but also kind of the wrong way. Like you're missing a few things here. So Kyle, I'd love to just hear, like, maybe you can just lead us into this conversation. Like, how do you think about valuing these L1 and L2, these protocol assets?
Yeah. Thanks for queuing up the question, Jason, with some good context. So actually, we have a full presentation on this. Tushar gave a keynote at the Multicoin Summit a couple of years ago, 2022, covering this. So I encourage you. Hopefully, we can get that added to the show notes or whatever.
Sure.
But for those that don't want to watch that, the way that we at Multicoin think about valuing asset ledgers, and that means L1s, L2s, L3s, pick your number of layers. But if the purpose of the system is to keep track of who has how many tokens and presumably people are trading tokens back and forth on the system, then in our view, the primary way you should think about value accrual is MEV for those systems. MEV will always exist in financial markets for all kinds of structural reasons. There's obviously good forms of MEV. There's bad forms of MEV, or I should say there's malicious and benign forms. We can get into, you know, malicious versus benign, but for we can maybe skip that for now and just understand that like this MEV exists. And that therefore, if you are a holder of an L1 asset, like for example, Sol or ETH, you are entitled to some of those rewards, MEV fees, both as a function of return yield via staking from your staking provider. So you can directly profit from that. I will note that there are some asset ledgers that do not share MEV back to their token holders. Probably the most notable of which is OP. I think Arbitrum does theoretically. Well, maybe I'm wrong on that.
If you're running the sequencer, then you're keeping all of the MEV to yourself, right?
Yeah, the Arbitrum DAO collects some fees somewhere, and it is accruing in there. I don't remember the source of those fees, but obviously,
theoretically, it's like Uniswap. Like the fees are there; they're not distributing them, but like it's accruing.
Well, in Uniswap, the fees aren't being accrued at all. In the case of Arbitrum, there are fees accruing somewhere. I don't remember the source of the fees, but I think most of the L2s and perhaps all of the L2s, although they could theoretically accrue tokens to respective token holders, they do not in practice today. L1s like Solana, Ethereum, Aptos, Sui, etc., all do have that direct value attribution.
Kyle, how do you think about the like evolution of how these things will start to get valued? And what I mean by that is like right now we can say they are valued on MEV, but they're not really. All these things are trading on just narratives right now. They're like trading on mainly speculation and narratives. I would argue, maybe you disagree with me. And then maybe there's an evolution to valuing these things on MEV, and then maybe it evolves into valuing them on something else. How do you think about that?
So I agree there's a lot of narrative component to it for sure. And let me take a step back. So I think MEV is the primary thing we think about. And I think as the ecosystem matures, that will become more prevalent and more industry observers will also generally come to that agreement because it maps to generally how people think about finance. And I think it's kind of first order correct. The weird thing about L1 assets in particular and or L2 or L3, but I'm going to call them asset ledger assets, is they do tend to exhibit this premium. Some people call it the monetary premium. I'm not sure I like that term. I would more call it like the non-sovereign store of value premia. I think that's maybe a better term for it. They do tend to exhibit that. And that at least empirically seems to add some value to the, to which it trades. And which all that does in terms of MEV is reduce the yield basically that you earn for holding the asset. Over time, I generally think you move more from speculation towards fundamentals. I think, I've been doing this for 6.5 years. And 6.5 years ago, there was zero discourse at all about fundamentals. And today, there's a whole bunch of people who at least attempt to have productive discourse about fundamentals. Obviously, we've got all the Dune dashboards and token terminal dashboards and all that stuff now. So, people are generally trying to quantify these things. And I think if you go forward another 6 years, I think, that will continue to mature. Mm-hmm. So I'd say it's been slower than I would have expected if you asked me from 6.5 years ago, like, hey, is there going to be confusion about, how to value ETH or Sol? I would have expected less confusion, but, we're moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm.
Can we double click on MEV itself? Like you hear a lot of people in the ETH community say, well, fees are extremely low in Solana. Therefore, like you need orders of magnitude more activity to justify what are high fees in the L1 and then L2 and Ethereum. My counter argument to that is, well, there's still MEV in Solana, but like I generally think of valuing these things of like, well, where do you think most of the activity is going to happen? In which network? And then you kind of discount that back. But like, what would you say to that criticism when you're thinking about MEV in context of the fees that are being generated by networks?
Yeah, fairly strongly held views here. I'll answer this both from the perspective you asked it and from the inverse perspective. I'll start with the inverse perspective. Blockchains are supposed to be like maximally permissionless. Like kind of everything boils down to like cost of compute or cost of hardware. That's kind of the long run end game for a lot of these things. This is why Uniswap has existed for 4 years without a fee switch, is because it turns out the fee switch is entirely optional for making the system work. Like we have empirical proof that it works, right? Without a fee switch. I think if you take that, it's fairly easy to reason about what a zero fee DeFi look like. It's harder to envision what zero fee L1 looks like. But like the answer would be, what is the cost of signature verification and memory and storage and bandwidth to compute a transaction? And then you need to obviously amortize that across the hardware and like for electricity costs, right? But like my general, I have an old tweet. I'll find it and send it to you guys. You can put it in the show notes that like tries to ballpark this within four orders of magnitude. Like I'm not trying to be super precise here, but like it's pretty obvious when you think of like what is the cost of electricity to do that kind of a thing. It's like on the order of a trillionth of a penny. Like it's kind of in that price range is like the actual COGS. And so then I look at like Ethereum and they're like, hey, it's $1 or $10 or whatever. And I'm like, I don't know, man, you're overpricing the COGS by a factor of a trillion. Like that just seems like a little fat to me. And so I have this like fairly deeply held belief that the cost of using the L1 should be approaching the COGS. This is generally true in capitalism across all industries. Obviously, generally things get cheaper and COGS go down and you're right, margins compress and all that stuff. I assume that, you know, in the long run, the profit margins will approach zero. So meaning like the cost of signature verification and executing a transaction should be even several orders of magnitude lower than it is now. I think even on Solana today, it's a few orders of magnitude too high. I don't think that fee stream, come back to your question, Santi, I don't think that fee stream is relevant at all, because it should go to zero. The history of software is the history of zero marginal cost, right? I mean, this is like the defining feature of software for the last 40 years. We're not there in crypto, but like we should be approaching that. To me, the only revenue stream that matters is MEV. And the beauty of MEV is MEV has nothing to do with the cost of signature verification and updating your memory and your bandwidth. MEV is a function of what are the state of financial markets, and producing, you know, arbitrages and whatever else that come naturally from the inherent heterogeneity and entropy in financial markets. And that's like crystal clear to us that the value of MEV is substantial today, like on the order of single digit billions across all of the ecosystems. And I see a pretty clear path for that to grow 100x to 1000x over the next 5 to 10 years. That, again, from my vantage point, is not a terribly controversial perspective. So
I was going to say, so just for so listeners to understand what you talk about, because MEV and Solana is like spiked up pretty substantially. And the reason is like, as there are more meme coins, there are more like, you know, things to trade, there's more usage in the chain than or demand, then there's going to be certain types of transactions where it had become, someone out there is going to pay a substantial premium for it to be for block inclusion.
Correct.
Now, can you like maybe just double click on like when you talk about like the sharing mechanism? So like if you're, for instance, you're a SOL holder, you're validating that through Jito or Marinade or some other, you know, validator, how much of that's actually shared back to versus kept? Like what is that distribution and does it vary? Because maybe if you could just focus on that.
Yeah. So the vast majority of MEV is going back to stakers. Validators, whenever they run, if you are running a Solana validator, you set your commission rate. That is actually a number you commit to and is on chain. Fun fact, Jito actually, they have this thing called StakeNet that will actually show you the history of every validator and what their historical commission rates have been over time and stuff. It's pretty sure it's live on their website. You can go check it out and you can see how people have fluctuated and stuff. So validator set a commission rate. I believe the median commission rate is something like 5%. So that means, you know, 5% of the MEV profits, so to speak, would be going to the validator and 95% would be going to, you know, to the staker. There are a handful of validators that recently have gone to 0% commission rates. Most notably, Helios announced this like a week or two ago. They went to a 0% commission rate.
What are the economics there for that? Like, for instance, Helios, like if you're running zero commission, then what is kind of their viable business model at that point?
Yeah, so implicitly that means that they look at validation as a loss leader. which I generally think is a reasonable assumption. And I think what that probably means is I don't know what Helios' specific business plan is. I have not asked Mert. I am an angel investor in Helios, but I do not know the answer. But I will speculate. And there's two fairly obvious speculative answers. One is they want to improve their own, as Solana moves to stake weighted quality of service, they want to maximize the amount of stake they have to maximize transaction inclusion guarantees so that they can offer a better RPC service to application developers. That seems fairly intuitive. And then the other way that you could monetize running a validator with 0% commission would just be via order flow auctions. So those two things make the most sense to me. I don't know. I suspect over time, all validators will generally move in this direction. I think it's inevitable that commission rates, if they don't go to zero as the equilibria, it will be like 0.5%, 1%. I don't think the median commission rate is going to be 5% in 5 years.
Is a proper analogy like Robinhood, like when they obviously don't charge fees, but they make a lot of money on order flow, like Citadel is printing.
Yes. Okay. That's correct.
Got it. Can you, just for our listeners, you mentioned this transition to stake weighted for Solana. Like, can you just make the distinction? Because people might not be aware of it.
Yeah. So this is an idea that Solana rolled out. Actually, they put out the code into mainnet in 2022. It has, I think, not been turned on or basically not been used and not, certainly not been hardened over the last couple of years. But it is turning on now. The core idea in stake weighted quality of service is there's a validator has open RPC connection. Anyone in the world can send them a transaction anytime. And by definition, you cannot know what the contents of the transaction are prior to receiving the contents of the transaction. So if people are sending you garbage, like it costs, forget even about compute or memory, it costs you bandwidth as a validator to just receive the content. When the cost of sending transactions is very close to zero, a lot of arbitrage bots are incentivized to just spam validators. And so the vast majority of Solana network traffic is arbitrage bots just spamming validators. The problem here is that like there's no way to run a market over bandwidth based on discriminating what the content is, because you can't know what the content is. The whole notion of parallel fee markets, for example, is predicated on understanding this thing goes in lane A, this thing goes in lane B, and this thing goes in lane C, right? But that means you have to be able to know A, B, and C are separate. But if you don't yet know what A or B or C is, then you can't even really run a functional market. So stake weighted quality of service is a way to create a market for bandwidth to reach the leader. And the way they do it is they say, hey, look, if you own 1% of the, if 1% of SOL is staked to your validator, then all of the other validators need to respect that 1% of their, they need to allocate up to 1% of their incoming bandwidth to you. And so this is basically a way to introduce Sybil resistance for the network layer of Solana. And in doing so, it implicitly creates a market for bandwidth to reach the validator. There's a bunch of discourse happening now on like, should we actually formalize that market in the protocol somehow, or should we not? Unclear exactly where those discussions will net out. But the zooming out, what stake weighted quality of service does is it basically dramatically increases the probability that a given piece of content from a known validator will in fact reach the leader.
Hmm. Kyle, I want to get back to this idea of like the valuation side of things. So if you are, do you think an L1 token needs MEV to be valuable?
Yes.
Okay. So the other side of this argument, if I were maybe arguing another camp, would say that an L1 token can basically just accrue value from two things, from increased demand from the L1 block space and from the monetary, if I'm in like ETH land, like ETH is money, that this whole narrative, like plus, so it can, it'll get value from increased demand from the L1 block space and the monetary premium from being like ETH is money, from being a de facto money across this entire ecosystem. What would you say to that side of the argument?
I think ETH is money is total nonsense. It's just this, to be the litmus test for being money is you need to price assets in it. And like people need to conduct commerce in, you know, in that pair. The only real assets that are priced in ETH or in SOL or NFTs There are a handful of pairs that are ETH denominated trading pairs for fungible tokens. But like, if you just look at AMM pools, the substantial majority of quote pairs are USDC and USDT, not ETH. So like just the empirical evidence suggests that that statement's false. So it's just like a fun thing people say because they have bags. I don't think SOL is money at all. I think it is a non-sovereign store of wealth, but it is very volatile. It is not money. Yeah. I think you need to be clear in that designation. That was half the question. What was the other half?
It was actually a leading question to get to. One thing that you actually had a really good call on was talking about like the price action of ETH in this cycle. And I remember we had a conversation at the first permissionless back in May 2022, and you were explaining to me how your belief that roll-ups were going to be and L2s were going to be very parasitic to the price of ETH, basically, because the L2 tokens end up capturing a lot of the MEV, which therefore does not accrue back to the L1 token, aka ETH. So it was your comments combined with that comment that you made to me a couple of years ago at permissionless. I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, we still continue to believe that. But by the way, the L2 tokens are generally not capturing it. It's the L2 sequencers. My theory was directionally correct, but mechanically incorrect.
Right.
Yeah. Kyle, I want to get your updated thesis on Solana. I've seen you also, as a firm, invested in, you know, other ecosystems. In this context of like MEV and just it's a bundled question, right? Because there's been, you know, people may have looked recently at the, you know, spam issue in Solana and say, oh, this is why, you know, we need Monad or we need other ecosystems or Sui, say Aptos or whatever. As a firm, how do you think about investing? Like if you were to redraw the portfolio from scratch today, are you still as excited about Solana versus everything else? How do you think about other ecosystems that are kind of getting attention?
Yeah, I think Solana is the fastest horse. I think it's either in the lead or pretty close to being in the lead on most of the metrics that matter. And in my opinion, the two most important metrics are trading volumes and MEV. And those two are very directly correlated with one another. I think the high degree of probability by the end of this calendar year, Solana is like blowing all other ecosystems out of the water on trading volume and MEV.
Kyle, what are the other metrics that matter? Just out of curiosity, MEV, trading volume, what are other ones that you care about?
I mean, like amount of interest being paid by borrowers is like interesting. But trading volume is like far and away the most important. But yeah, those are the main ones. In terms of like redrawing the portfolio from scratch and like thinking about what I'm excited about, I'd say our general conviction in the integrated approach has increased over the last couple of years as we've seen the modular stuff start to play out. And so that means we're pretty bullish Solana and Aptos. We are investors in both. We're obviously following Monad, we're following Sui. Those are probably the other two kind of like major contenders in that thesis. But generally, we are increasingly convinced that's the right approach. And I think a lot of what's, again, I'll answer that from two perspectives. One from the challenges with a modular thing, and the second from the strengths of the integrated thing. On the strengths of the integrated thing, what all of the network spam stuff in Solana has shown in the last 3 months is as you grow demand to use these systems, transaction volumes increase. That's kind of tautological. And like things break, and you can't know ahead of time all of the things that are going to break. But by definition, no company has ever scaled a software system without it things breaking. And like as a general statement, every 10x, like things break in meaningful ways that you can't expect. And anyway, you know, like this is pretty common knowledge in software engineering. And so I look at, you know, the challenges the Solana teams have faced starting back in 2022 when they introduced Quick and stakeholder quality service, and now looking at the scheduler problems they're having, and now they're redoing Quick because like whatever, Quick had some problems in it and there's a bug in it, all these things that they're dealing with. We thought that like they addressed the core problems in 2022, and like they partially addressed them, but they didn't completely address them. And then like, you know, new problems surfaced later as demand load increased. The more modular your system is, And specifically, the more there are different teams who do not are not like bound to coordinate with one another, and in some cases who are directly competitive with one another, and who have diverging economic incentives because those people, their net worths are denominated primarily in different tokens. Like, it's going to be harder to coordinate to implement the fixes. And like, the fixes are never singular in nature. Like, the problems span some combination of networking, software, engineering, and economics. And like, maybe there's a problem that does in fact isolate to like one of those domains, but collectively thinking about like the entirety of the system requires you to be thinking across all of those domains. And so, you know, splitting up like the decision-making between different teams with diverging economics seems like you're effectively guaranteed to a suboptimal outcome. Mm-hmm. And you want, you know, all of the, you want the system to be aligned, right, around a single set of integrated economics, so to speak. So that's one vantage point to your question of why we've become, you know, watching Solana's growing pains has made us more convicted in that approach. Because I don't know how you deal with this problem in the context of Ethereum. And I can give some interesting counterfactuals on that if you're curious. The other side of this is like, what have we learned about the modular stuff in the last, call it 12, 18 months? 18 months ago, we were pretty skeptical that there was like a, what I would call an A+ solution. There are like lots of B to B+ solutions. I'm pretty confident an A+ solution is intractable at this point. And in my mind, A+ means zero slippage to end users. So meaning, you know, your $10 on this the starting chain is $10 on the receiving chain and you don't get 9.9. That's damn near impossible for anything that's not a centrally issued stablecoin. Obviously latency is a huge problem. On all of these and then gas costs and then getting all of the wallets to integrate and support it and all the other compounding things. What we've generally seen in that space is more IQ has shown up to tackle it. Kind of the most interesting recent batch of that's been, I think, probably the chain abstraction stuff led by the Near folks, which I actually find to be quite architecturally elegant. The problem is just like, it's another standard. And the meta problem with all of the modularity stuff is that there is no standard. Like it's explicitly a standards problem. You've got whatever, OP stack, ARB stack, Espresso and Astria now, I don't know how those impact. You've got Monad, you've got Say, you've got Starkware, you've got ZK Sync, you've got Scroll, you have all these different things. All of these things have very subtle, unique subtlety, Polygon to their respective systems. None of them are sitting down in a room together and like trying to create a common standard between all of them. And so everything within their ecosystems, they promise theoretically will be magical and will be A+. Look, none of them have delivered that yet. We'll see if any of them do. But it seems somewhere between distant and impossible to get all of these teams that have built their own standards to then also build kind of like a meta standard. That seems really hard. So our conviction has increased generally that the fragmentation of standards is effectively guaranteed to produce a worse user experience.
When you say that, are you mostly looking at through the lens of like composability or like user experience or all of the above? Is this pretty fragmented?
Yeah, UX. This is really UX for users. And like there's a couple of items that to me, probably the single most important item is what does my, if I make a $100 transfer, do I get $100 on the other side? Or if I make a whatever, 2 ETH transfer, do I get 2 ETH on the other side? You can complain about how shitty TradFi is all you want, but like I can move my Apple stock from Morgan Stanley to Robinhood and I don't lose Apple shares along the way. Now it's slow, the paperwork is terrible, but like I don't reset my tax basis. There's no question about that. And like all of the shares transfer. And like crypto today is like, it doesn't even seem like the teams building these systems care about preserving that property. And I think given the prevalence of Venmo and other basic consumer financial services, it's very hard to see large scale acceptance when your $100 turns into 99.5. It just like rubs people the wrong way. They're like, what do you mean? Where did my, you know, just, it, yeah. So,
yeah. You guys, I think recently did announce a big round of Wormhole, I believe, right?
That's correct.
What was the thesis there? Is it just more flow into ecosystems away from Ethereum into Solana and then capturing that some way or?
Yeah. The world is clearly multi-chain. It's clearly going to be multi-chain. There's a tremendous amount of inertia in the EVM specifically. I think the amount of inertia is generally growing in the SVM. And you need to connect all of these systems. I spent the last 10 minutes complaining about connecting all of these systems. And like, I stand by the fact that I believe it's fundamentally intractable to build a connective layer that is equivalent to intra asset ledger movements. But like, look, the world is not homogenous. And so like, just for sheer political reasons and other weird historical path dependency reasons, there will be multiple ecosystems. I'm not saying like everyone will agree on Solana or Aptos or Say or whatever. So I just recognize like, yeah, there's going to be multiple of these things. And Wormhole is certainly has the most kind of robust product package today in offering the connectivity tools for multiple different kinds of interop, not just pegged assets, but a bunch of other cool things you can do cross chain. Mm-hmm.
You've been in space for quite a long time. I remember perhaps talking to you in the early days. And how do you think about IBC when you look at Wormhole? And is Cosmos, anything happening in the Cosmos ecosystem, or just IBC in particular, interesting to you? Or
The more time that goes by, the more I appreciate the design goals of IBC and the fact that at least technically they like. They did what they said they were going to do. IBC feels irrelevant, not for technology reasons, but for go to market reasons. It's just the amount of adoption of Tendermint Cosmos chains is limited. And it doesn't seem like there's a super clear path for that to change in the foreseeable future. But generally, technically, it's pretty elegant. Wormhole and Layer Zero and Axelar and Across and all of these other things are all directly a response to the fact, two things. One, that Ethereum specifically has effectively eschewed any notion of an IBC equivalent standard for the EVM. I don't fully appreciate why that's been the case, but I mean, like this hasn't even made it up into like public discourse of like a thing that should be considered in a serious way in the last 7 years. And given Cosmos has been around for all that time, I suspect there's like some pretty, you know, deep, views held by some core folks of the foundation who have like, you know, basically poo-pooed on that anytime someone's tried to bring it up in ETH research forums or whatever. And then the other major reason Wormhole and Axelar and Layer Zero and these guys exist is to then deal with the lack of a standard between EVM, SVM move, and then all of the EVM flavors. So there's always going to be a market there for that stuff. Just given the inherent lack of standards.
This episode is brought to you by Say. Say's belief about the world, I think, is a good one. They believe that the EVM is here to stay. I agree with that. They believe that the EVM is going to look kind of like what JavaScript ended up looking like in the Web 2 world. I agree with that. They also believe that the EVM in its current iteration lacks a lot of the performance and scalability that developers need. So what Say has done with their V2 upgrade is they just introduced the first high performance parallelized EVM into the market today. They've got lightning fast block times and finality of just 390 milliseconds. What this does is it unlocks an entirely new design space with 100x the throughput of even some of the fastest EVM L2s on the market today. Say V2 is now live on public devnet with mainnet scheduled for Q2. You can stay up to date with Say on X at Say Network, SEI Network. Big thanks to Say. This episode is brought to you by Monad. Monad's thesis is simple. The EVM is here to stay, similar to JavaScript and Web 2, but unfortunately, today's EVM lacks the high performance and the scalability that developers need to make certain applications possible. Monad addresses these concerns and these bottlenecks while preserving seamless EVM composability for application developers. There's a seamless transition to Monad as the Ethereum RPC API allows for really easy portability. And for developers, Monad can support 10,000 real transactions per second with their unique parallel execution environment. And of course, there's full compatibility with EVM bytecode. Monad's internal DevNet is live. Public testnet comes out soon. You can join Monad's journey in two ways. One, go follow them. They're on Twitter at Monad, M-O-N-A-D underscore XYZ. And also join the Monad Discord. It's discord.gg/Monad. Big thanks to Monad for sponsoring Empire. Hey everyone, Santi and I have been talking about Solana a lot recently, and we're excited to have a Solana sponsor of Empire. Marinade is a staking protocol in Solana. I remember when they launched, I think it was back at a Solana hackathon, and they were funded with this 80K grant. It's super cool to see how far they've come. They're the only stake pool today that delivers auto rebalancing, MEV rewards, and automatic downside protection with their new protected staking rewards. You can stake natively or liquid stake with Marinade and get the same high performance delegation strategy that thousands are using already to stake your SOL to over 100 of the best Solana validators. Marinade has been live for over 2 years, and they have audits completed by 4 of the top security firms in crypto. The delegation strategy is a first of its kind. So if you're staking your Solana, if you want to start staking your Solana, if you want to get some yield from your SOL, start staking today with Marinade. Go hit the link in the show notes. Big thanks to Marinade for everything that they've done in Solana staking land. Go check them out. Go stake your Solana with Marinade today. This episode is brought to you by Mantle. Mantle is an L2 backed by one of the industry's largest treasuries. At the time of recording, it's valued at $4.4 billion. The Mantle ecosystem engages in a lot of early stage exciting projects such as Athena and Eigenlayer, and they give out actually the rewards to the Mantle community. There are two airdrops I want to tell you about. The first one, it was with Athena. They offered 2.5 billion Athena shards to holders of their native token MNT. So the reward station program distributes these pre-sale token allocations to MNT holders who stake the tokens. The second one they have going on is with MYSO, M-Y-S-O. That gives out over 90,000 MYSO tokens worth about $50,000 today. That starts on April 25th, runs through May 2nd. If you want to check that out, you got to stake your MNT, and you can check out the reward station at mantle.xyz/reward station. Big thanks to Mantle for sponsoring Empire.
I want to get just your take generally on fee markets. Just going back to that, feels like really suboptimal across. It feels like the area where more innovation is going to be required. You're all basically pricing it in a suboptimal way. To your point around, it's really hard to price these things when, like, you kind of have to constantly update them as you grow 10x. We've had Anatoly and Ben talk about it, and it's something that Solana Foundation's kind of focused on. But when you compare kind of fee markets across ecosystems, is there one design that you really like, or just teams that you think are thinking about it the right way?
I'm not an expert in certainly, especially the economics side of these and thinking about designing fee systems or auctions and all that kind of stuff. There's people who study that professionally. I've never studied it at all. So I definitely won't say I'm an expert here. And I'll say, like, having observed the ecosystem over the last 6 years, the thing I've come to appreciate is there are more layers to the system. I should say there are more sub markets within the system than I originally appreciated. The best example of that would be the stake weighted quality of service thing that I just talked about a few minutes ago. I never thought about a market for bandwidth to reach the leader. But if you think about it in the extreme, it may not need to be a market explicitly with, like, bids and asks, but there is some problem you have to deal with there. Some stable resistance problem, and one way to deal with stable resistance problems is to meter it with the market. Another example would be parallel fee markets. When we first invested in Solana, Anatoly was clear parallelism of execution, and I was like, cool, like, I understood, Moore's law and scaling horizontally in silicon. So that's why we got all excited in 2018. We didn't actually go a few steps forward though and say, well, let's think about the fee markets and, like, localizing that to hotspots and, like, that kind of a thing. And actually, I don't even think Anatoly did either. I think they built parallel fee markets after mainnet went live. So it was just kind of an emergent property that, like, because of the design of the system and the fact that the transaction headers all include all of the state up front, that you could, it was, you know, fairly trivial to build. Yeah. To build parallel few markets, localized few markets later. So, you know, I look at obviously the blob storage now on Ethereum in the last couple months. So, I think coming back to your original question of like, what's the correct way to design fee markets? I have no idea. I think as you continue to grow demand in these systems and things break in weird and funny ways, you wouldn't have thought about them ahead of time. And so you need to kind of be like adjusting the fee systems over time. That's the generic answer. The other thing I would say that I generally find to be interesting, Tarun Chitra gave a talk at Breakpoint last year about multidimensional fee markets. Generally a pretty good talk. I think he also wrote a paper on it. But perhaps the most interesting thing that he highlighted in that paper that is getting some discourse today in kind of Solana research forums is introducing a 1559-like fee system per unit of state in Solana. So this would be like combining local fee markets in Solana with 1559. It's an interesting idea. I know there are some people in the Solana community who don't like it. There are some people who really do like it. But we can clearly see that fee markets are just becoming inherently more multidimensional. And I think we're probably 3 to 5 years away from like getting to some equilibria state on this. I don't think we're close to the end of the iteration cycle around fees in these systems.
Maybe last question on MEV and how you think about like expressing that view. You can perhaps invest in stuff like Jito. I know you guys are investors in Jito. You know, you can invest in Flashbots of the world. When you think about the relative like outperformance, like would you like, if you have like $10, would you rather invest in something like Jito? Obviously it depends on the valuation and whatnot, but like versus the L1, like what do you think has perhaps more interesting investment potential?
Yeah, so assets like LDO or JTO should be thought of, they should be priced against ETH and SOL respectively. And so like we only look at those two assets internally, specifically against ETH and against LDO. I'm obviously more familiar with the Jito roadmap than I am with the LIDAR roadmap. The LIDAR, so I can't really comment on like what I think is happening in LIDAR land. Also like all the restaking stuff is just weird and still too early to really know how it's going to play out. I can tell you in Jito land, the team is not done shipping. They're going to continue to do stuff. And I think that probably the stuff they will do will, in general, like be accretive to accruing, justifying a higher JTO SOL price. The Jito guys know what they're doing and they're in a position to continue to figure out how to get more SOL distributions to JTO holders.
Maybe we can move into the next part of the convo about this this token terminal tweet that kind of sparked some conversations over the weekend. So I can share it here. So this basically said the token terminal tweeted out the income statements, as they put it, for Base and Solana. And what it showed was that Solana, I'll put quotes around this, lost $796 million. In Q1 and Base made $15 million. So yeah, I mean, ignoring the fact that we're kind of comparing an L1 with a token to an L2 without a token, it brought up a conversation around like issuance as an expense basically, or like how should you categorize the cost of a token? And Kyle, actually, I mean, both you guys would love to hear how both you guys think about this and just maybe like the flaws in this token terminal tweet that obviously a lot of people pointed out.
Yeah, Santi, you want to go first here or you want me to take it?
I'll lead the way, sir.
Yeah, so a lot of problems with this methodology. One is it's showing emissions of Solana as 100% a cost to all SOL holders. That's what's implied in the statement. And that's just wrong because like 85% of SOL is staked. 80 to 85%. It's in that range. So like if you're staking your soul, then you're not eating that cost because you're accruing the inflationary soul there. That's like just incorrect for that reason. What you are eating as a cost is the commission rate that you're paying to the validator, which by the way, Helios and others now offer zero, right? So that doesn't really capture like the economic reality of how people experience, you know, it as a soul holder.
On that note, Kyle, just to make sure I understand that. So is your idea that like at some point based on the amount of supply that's staked, issuance should or should not be treated as an expense? So like, let's say like if over 50% is of the supply is staked, maybe new issuance should not be treated as an expense since it like, what is your...
No. So that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that like there's some threshold you should use to counter. I'm okay. Just saying it like... You can build these like aggregate network metric dashboards, which is what that kind of is, but like fails to capture the reality that like if you are an individual SOL holder, you can choose to stake your SOL.
Yeah.
If you're staking, you're not getting diluted.
If you're yeah, exactly. In fact, you're being reverse diluted because there are some percentage of people who aren't staking.
Yeah. Exactly.
No network has ever achieved 100% stake utilization, and no network ever will for a bunch of reasons. So like it ignores. Like, this is the funny thing that, like, all the Bitcoiners are like, 21 million, hard cap, you know, yeah, no inflation. And that's actually economically stupid to say, because in any proof of stake network, if you stake your tokens, you are guaranteed to beat the rate of inflation. So actually, proof of stake networks in 100% of cases offer you better guarantees about your percentage ownership of the money supply
than
proof of work
network. All right, sorry, I interrupted. Go. All right, so you're getting on to point number two.
Yeah. Second problem with that claim, or that dashboard thing, is it's only looking at fee revenue, meaning like gas. It's not including MEV, which like we talked about earlier. My expectation is that gas revenue should go to effectively zero. We underwrite it as zero internally. Like, we don't care how much money people are spending on gas as far as aggregate network valuation is concerned. Obviously, you care about it as an individual user of like what's the user experience, but it doesn't matter. MEV is what matters, and the MEV number is like something like 10 or 20 or 30x the gas number. So you're missing the biggest revenue item. And then obviously the third is you're comparing a system with a centralized sequencer against a system with 3,000 nodes around. Like, it's an apples to oranges comparison. You know, like, you are getting a fundamentally different set of trust guarantees between those two things.
Yeah, just to reiterate that, like, if you look at on the right side, I don't know if you have it pulled open, but on the right side, like, you have for Solana transaction fees, like, where are the priority fees? You're not including those. So, you know, fundamentally flawed. So revenue understated. Then on the expense side, yeah, again, like, issuance is not an expense. Like, I'll hold the line on that. We keep coming back to this, like, and it's kind of like idiotic at some point. It just tells you how unsophisticated people are in crypto. It's like, if you're staking, you're not being diluted. In fact, to your cause point, because there's not 100% issuance, you're actually benefiting from that. This analysis doesn't factor that in. So it's kind of irrelevant. It makes me more bullish on like investing behind Solana. It's just like, yeah, great. Okay, fine. People don't understand this. And we're like, how many times do we have to bring it up again and again and again? But, you know.
Santi, would you say this changes in a proof of work model? So you could say in a proof of work model that issuance is absolutely an expense because the network is paying an external service provider, aka the miners, mm-hmm. for a service, which is the security, right? But maybe so does that change in proof of work?
I believe so. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Kyle. Like, in that case, yes, because the miner, like, you're not benefiting from that. And not only that, the issue that I have with proof of work, moreover, is it has a constant, like, you have an actor in the system that has a clear incentive to dump that token to recoup the CapEx, which is electricity, which is really, really high relative to proof of stake. People should go listen to the latest episode that we recorded with Anatoly and Ben, where Anatoly goes back to, like, really, like, simplifies the P&L of Solana. Like, here's the revenue and here are the different cogs. Like, what are the cogs, to Kyle's point, like bandwidth, storage, and something else. And just thinking about that today and going forward, like, the hardware requirements of Solana and the actual costs here, I don't know how they're like actually coming to that. I think they're it's like, I don't have the analysis fully, the detail of it, but it's a common criticism of people looking at Solana. At one point I was very stuck on higher hardware requirements, but like, that episode with Anatoly really, I think, crystallizes the P&L of Solana in a very, in a very useful way. If people want to go listen to that, they should. It's far more interesting than this analysis.
I'm going to go into dangerous territory for myself here and try to play the other side against you guys here. So just All right, in proof of work, if Bitcoin is if issuance is an expense in proof of work with Bitcoin, right? You've got the network is paying an external service provider, aka the miners, for a service, which is security. Mm-hmm. Maybe technically, yeah, issuance is not an expense in proof of service. With Solana, it's not. But maybe if you modeled out a proof of stake, I mean, you can model out a blockchain as an equivalent business, like Anatoly was mentioning, Santi. Like the business sells block space, pays the validators to maintain the chain. And in that model, if you're trying to like map this out on a spreadsheet, the issuance to the validators, I think, would be an expense to the business, and the fees are burnt. The fees that are burnt plus the MEV, as Kyle's arguing, would be income to the business. Tell me one more time why that's wrong.
The commission rate is what you're paying to the validators to literally physically host the network. That is correct. So that is a real and that's an expense that SOL holders are paying. Like if you are a holder of SOL, you are paying someone to run hardware to keep the network moving forward. So that's real. Where I disagree is saying all inflation is a cost to SOL holders, because you can just trivially opt in to staking your SOL.
The relationship I think you have to look at is the commission that you're paying, the actual MEV, like the amount, right? Like what is the profitability for a staker? If you're staking a Jito or staking a Helios, different, right? Based on the commission. And also like you're getting those rewards, you know, part of those rewards, that inflation back to you. Plus also some of this other, like the other fee item, which is far more interesting, as Kyle was mentioning, which is MEV. Mm. So like, I think it's on a case by case basis, but generally speaking, like, If you're a SOL holder, you should probably just think about, okay, you're probably holding SOL because you believe the network, you know, is interesting because it's getting a lot of activity, therefore a lot of MEV, therefore you're not going to be diluted because you're staking, plus you stand to benefit by, you know, getting Jito rewards or, you know, part of the MEV shared over to you.
What do you think, Kyle, if you were designing, so we've actually done this exercise, a bunch of Blockworks research, like maybe we're trying to shove a, you know, square peg in a round hole here, right? Maybe we're trying to put these like things into crypto terminology, into like equities terminology with revenue and expenses. Like if you were designing, someone said, Kyle, we're trying to standardize how we value these crypto assets. We know MEV plays a role here, but like what are the equivalent of like revenue and expenses? Like maybe it's fees and emissions, or, you know, how would you basically, at some point we're going to have to like create these standards of metrics for these crypto assets. Like, how do you think about that beyond just MEV?
MEV is the only revenue driver that I care about. Mm. I don't care about any other revenue driver. I think the other kind of just like source of confusion here is like doing it at a network level versus at an EPS level or per token level. Yeah. That kind of accounts for the second discrepancy in communication.
Kyle, what's the best way to think about like the evolution of MEV? Like, how do you think, like, there's clearly a lot of MEV happening increasingly so in Solana, but like you talk about like transaction fees kind of like going to the marginal cost and compressing really aggressively. How do you think about MEV in that context, like as a percentage, like the amount of profitability over time?
I'd say two
like there's always going to be arbitrage.
Two trends that I think will hold true indefinitely. One is amount of heterogeneity in the market, amount of entropy in the market will increase over time. I think this is, what's the third law of thermodynamics or whatever, like, you know, entropy increases in the universe. I generally think that is also true in financial markets. There's more venues, there's more unsophisticated participants, there's more sophisticated participants. In the case of Solana, there's like literally more leader, like more validators join. So there's more leaders rotating through the system. That's obviously not a law of physics in the way that the thermodynamics law is, but my empirical observation is that the total amount of entropy in these systems is increasing over time. And I think that will be true. And that entropy explicitly produces MEV. And then the second, I think, general thing that I expect to hold true indefinitely is application developers will work to minimize malicious MEV, which I think is great. I think there's a very weird view that is held at more in the Ethereum community that getting rid of MEV is the job of the L1 or the L2, whatever the asset ledger. And like there are ways you can design the asset ledger to minimize MEV. The most aggressive of which is like what Osmosis and others do, where they encrypt the mempool ahead of time in the transactions and randomly order them in a block, which by the way has its own serious problems in terms of guarantees you offer for users as well as performance on the system. But ignoring that, I've kind of come to the belief that application developer's job is the one to optimize for specifically for minimizing malicious MEV. Obviously, if you're being sandwiched, like that's bad. But like this is solvable at the UI layer and at the API layer. A bunch of people are working on this. Uniswap, Dflow, a bunch of others.
CowSwap.
Yeah. There's a lot of approaches to this, but I believe that the total amount of entropy is growing and good faith application developers are trying to minimize malicious forms of MEV, which is great. And those two things will, well, for an individual user, that their UX will generally improve because of that. And that will obviously bring in more demand and I should hopefully grow the entire pie for everybody.
Maybe you've said it before, but just maybe stupid of me, but how do you like characterize bad, evil MEV? Like looking from the
outside. Malicious MEV is the most explicit form of this is sandwiching, where you are quite literally like abusing the market structure to take money from someone. Sandwiching is there maybe
usually with swaps, right? You want to buy like a meme coin, whatever. So you want to buy WIF, and then someone front runs you, and then you end up paying a higher price.
Correct. That's explicitly like malicious. The most of the other forms of MEV are, as far as I can understand, pretty benign. So liquidations, I think it's benign. Like, hey, you're out to get liquidated, fine. Back running an Oracle, again, fine. Like once the Oracle price is updated, like someone needs to bring systems in line. Seems reasonable. Dex arbitrage, totally reasonable. Like the LPs are the ones being stupid, quoting bad pairs. And so great arbitragers, you know, need to, their job is to bring the price in line. Sex Dex arbitrage, again, same thing. So those all forms of MEV I consider to be somewhere between benign and even positive. Like they actually make the system work better. And then obviously like anything involving front running is bad.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. When you, I guess most recently people have been pretty critical of meme coins, particularly for this sandwiching kind of effect. And, you know, but you're still of the mind, look, MEV in the aggregate continues to grow. If there's more entropy, you know, heterogeneity in the system. But over time, like maybe the user, you know, this malicious MEV goes down. When you're doing a swap on Jupiter, you know, you could, there's ways to like minimize sandwiching, but there's still going to be a ton of MEV in the aggregate.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. What else should we talk about?
Kyle, I want to get your take on this. Actually, both of your guys' take. I think I know the answer to this based on just this conversation that we just had. But
yeah, no, you always know the answer to everything.
Here's the cost of these airdrops in on a Richard Chen Dune dashboard, which is like if you basically just take the number of airdrops multiplied by the price of the token.
At the time of issuance, or like, or is the price of the token like smoothed out?
Including like the, you know, including price appreciation. So for anyone who's not watching on YouTube, Arbitrum cost of airdrop 1.4 billion, DYDX 1.45 billion, ApeCoin 8.5 billion, ENS 1.1 billion, Blur 340 million, Uniswap 658 million. If a portfolio company, Kyle, came to you and basically showed
you... Wait a minute, can we tell Richard to like put it as a percentage of FTV? Because like I think that would be far more interesting. Like if you think about like what is
that? That would be interesting. So there's two ways to view this. One is, holy shit, this is like the most expensive marketing campaign of all time. That's like that's insane. That's a $1 billion marketing campaign. The other way to view it is like, wow, this is a great marketing campaign. It's basically free because the cost to, you know, create these tokens is essentially free. How do you guys view this?
Elements of both. So I think one thing that is not captured in the discourse around this is you need to have float. Anyone who does a 1-3% float is criticized, low float, you know, high FTV, classic thing. The primary reason most tokens launch with a small float is not because the teams want to have a low float. It's because all of the other tokens are locked. All of the investors are locked and all of the employees are locked. And the foundation is obviously not dumping on day one. So it's like, well, where the hell does the float come from? I really don't like the statement of the marketing cost of the drop, because that statement implies you could have cut the marketing cost in half. Like there was some sort of discretion in choosing to spend that much money on marketing.
Right.
I really don't like, I think it is entirely possible to get 10% of tokens floating on day one. 20% is hard, not impossible, but it's hard. But I think any team, if they care about not distorting the market too much, if they care about trying to help the asset find true price discovery as effectively as is possible for a new asset, then you should gain a minimum of 10%. And if you can get to 20, that's spectacular. Very few people have gotten to 20. So that's comment A. I think the marketing framing implies too much discretion. B, for better or for worse, there's an expectation that people in crypto participate in these things. I don't necessarily love that sense of entitlement, but it is clearly real. And for certain protocols, justified and legitimate. For many protocols, I believe it is not justified and legitimate. For example, if you're getting tokens for you joined the Discord, I don't know, man. That seems pretty fucking weak to me. But if you put your capital in, Margin and Kamino are both expected to drop their tokens on Solana very soon. They're both borrow-lend protocols. They're comparable to Compound and Aave on Ethereum. With those systems, if you're the first money to deposit in those systems, you are taking smart contract risk explicitly. There's no way around that fact. You'll earn a market rate for borrow-lend, whatever, in the early days. But you're taking this risk that really you can't be compensated for by the lender or by the borrower, rather, if you're a lender. And so it makes sense to me that you should get tokens for taking that risk, right? That fundamentally is justifiable. So my point is in some sense, you want to reward people who genuinely contributed to your system, because someone has to be the first person to take the risk that your contracts don't blow up. And they should be compensated for that. In the case of DPIN, obviously, hey, if you help build the infrastructure, you should be compensated for that. You bought the hotspot, you laid out the cash, you put it in, whatever. You drove more miles in your car in Hivemapper. Clearly, you should be compensated. So I'm generally a fan of using airdrops to get tokens in the hands of people. I think that they have been overused by teams that, quite frankly, don't have good ideas of how to do some notion of value attribution. And then it's just wasteful. Then it just feels stupid. Any of these systems where people are clearly farming, I know Starkware and ZK Sync have gotten a bunch of shit for this. I don't know if it's true or not, but let's just assume that it's true for a second. The rumors are true. The people who are putting money in Starkware and then not doing anything, they're not really creating long-term durable value for Starkware. They're not making the probability that the fraud proofs, the validity proofs function. They're not improving the probability that happens. They're not increasing liquidity in the system. So those kinds of things I don't like. But I love the permissionless capital formation that crypto offers. And if you can airdrop things to people in a productive way, you absolutely should.
I mean, the other component, I heard you say once, there's a particular team in Solana in the very early days that airdrop a huge amount. And it was kind of a vampire attack to get people to get interested in Solana at the time where most networks to get them off the ground, you have this the activation energy that's required. And so I think, I forget which particular project, but like the other component is, in a parallel universe, like what would have happened if you didn't have this incentive? Like you're in many ways kind of growing the pie. It's a way to attract attention. Everything is, you're competing for attention in this space. So I definitely agree with Kyle. Like if it's very easy to think about like how to airdrop in a DeFi protocol, difficult for other systems. What I really have liked, and there's also nuance, right? Like the way Jupiter is doing it, I think is pretty clever. Same as Blur. Like there's different campaigns. UMA was kind of the first one to introduce this concept of you don't have to airdrop everything all at once. Like you're going to be blowing all your load. Like you're going to probably regret that 5 years, 10 years down the road. Like how are you going to pay partners? Like Wi-Fi was a perfect example of this. Andre being Andre, just, you know, all the Wi-Fi was in circulation. And then, oh, how are you going to incentivize apps to deposit into the vaults? How are you going to pay developers? How are you going to use these? So like, I think like, you know, I understand why Bitcoin had to codify block emissions, but if you're a protocol, like just, you know, the, I think, I don't know what, how to solve it other than going back to maybe ICOs where like you have just way more distribution. Meme coins don't have this problem, but like Worldcoin, 2% of all the supply is out. Like, good luck.
By the way, with Worldcoin, Worldcoin is actually the one project that I think it is explicitly justified to have a tiny float. Because the whole point of the system is that like every person gets one token,
Tokens, whatever
over it is, time. So
you can't control the high FTV though. It's which is
you can't. You can't. I'm just saying that's the look. By again, disclosure: we're investing in WorldCoin, but like it's the one project where I'm like, no. That's the whole point of the system. You can't criticize it for that. But yeah, it's bad for teams to play the low float high FTV game. You should generally aim for 10%. If you don't want to airdrop all of that up front, figure out how to do an LBP, figure out how to do an offering with CoinList or with Jupiter or with a bunch of people out there. It is generally better to have people buy into your vision than to be airdropped tokens for free. It does increase people's commitments if they have to put cash down to get engaged.
I think Curve was a really good example. Like I'm not of the mind. So like if you're going to airdrop 20, there's going to be a lot of people that might sell out of the gate. There are teams that come to me and say, should we lock it? Should it have some sort of lockup, vesting per block, whatever. I don't know. I feel like it sort of defeats the purpose of having like low float. Whereas the better, more elegant solution might be incentivize people to lock it like a Curve kind of, mechanism where people can deposit that at earn more fees or whatever, like Blur, you could do this, right? You, instead of selling your airdrop, you can like stake it, maybe earn blast rewards or whatever, there's just like better ways to do that, I think.
Yeah. One way to think about lockups is lockups explicitly distort the price. I don't mean that's like malicious, but like there are people who are locked up who would otherwise not be holding. And conversely, there are people who will not buy until the lockups have expired.
Right.
And so in both directions, like, when you have lockups, lock tokens, you are moving away from the organic price. Again, there's good reason to have lockups, but like just recognize that they distort reality. And I generally think that like people need to try to, get these systems to be getting closer to, away from the reality distortion as quickly as you can. Is roll out a token.
If Richard or anyone else is listening, I'd love someone to like actually come up with cohort retention curves for these airdrops and campaigns, because there's a lot of chatter, but like how expensive they are. Well, let's look at the retention. I remember talking to the Badger team super early on, and they, I think, were pretty clever in like pioneering like the criteria for the airdrop, and they had like pretty decent retention, like 30, 60 days out of the, like after the airdrop, like a lot of people actually held on to Badger. Then of course, there's a lot of noise, right? Because the markets can tank and there's vol and people start getting liquidated where they want to sell the airdrop, right? Thing that you get for free, like common psychology. But yeah, it'd be really nice to kind of look at all these airdrops, particularly in the Solana land, because you have like just more retail folks and just kind of observing that.
Yeah. I just saw some breaking news from Blockworks, which is Stripe is bringing back crypto payments on Solana. So
there we go.
Woo-hoo!
By the way, can I get you guys, like I've been like funding obviously more soul based projects, and like when I try to fund in USDC, like, is it me or like, does Coinbase not so easily support like withdrawing Sol USDC?
It does for me. Coinbase Prime does not support. Yeah, does not support SPL. Prime,
no.
So I withdraw from Coinbase Prime to Coinbase Consumer, and then I withdraw from Coinbase Consumer and SPL. I have yelled at the Prime team many times. I'm sure no one has complained about this feature to the Prime team more than I have.
Okay, well, I'm publicly complaining. God damn it. Like, I need to buy Sol Swap. Like, it's like, come on, guys. Get your shit together.
Yeah, very annoying.
Anyways.
Kyle, thanks for coming on, man.
Anything else you want to talk about, Kyle?
Pleasure for having me back on the show. I think next time I'm on, we can just complain. Every feature request we have for any product or service in crypto, we can just complain for an hour and a half.
All right, fun fact, Kyle, you've been cycling a lot. I love cycling. When's the next race? When's the next thing?
Oh man, I think I decided that I'm done with endurance for a little while. I'm back in the weight room for the summer at least. And I'm gonna kick Anatoly's ass in the weight room. That's my goal.
Oh wow, okay. So, Anatoly's lifting some pretty heavy stuff. So
Anatoly and Keone. I think I'm gonna put both of them to shame.
Okay, all right. I will not. So I'll just be cycling. Anyways, Kyle, really nice coming on. We'll have to have you on sometime soon and keep the conversation going. Really treat.
All right, guys. Santi, Jason, thanks so much. Awesome to chat, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yep. Cheers. All right, you heard about Say a couple times. Just want to give them one last shout out. Big thanks to Say for sponsoring this episode of Empire. There are a ton of reasons to build on Say. If you want to get in touch with them, you can reach out to me. I'll put you in touch directly with the team. You can also get in touch with them on Twitter at Say Network. You can follow the journey at Say Network. They are currently live. They've got Say V2 on public DevNet today. Mainnet goes live later in Q2. Really excited to have Say sponsoring and partnering with us on this episode of Empire.